Well, of course we're worried, but we have to get through this. And here in the village, we will still celebrate Christmas.
Freezing temperatures, no power, and no signs of the war's end. The stories of fortitude and hope of the Ukrainian people as they continue their fight for peace.
The Catholic Lifesaver Corps is so unique, it's so on the cutting edge. The idea of peer-to-peer training and support around suicide prevention.
A budding program that focuses on mental health in teens, aims to save lives and build a better understanding of the sanctity of life.
He said, I have a question for you. Can we go to Jerusalem, you think?
Helping families of Coptic Christians who were martyred for their faith, the pilgrimage they hope to take to bring them closer to Christ.
Most of the players have a very devout and sincere faith in their faith group, and it motivates them.
And a world stage to evangelize the Catholic faith both on and off the field. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
We were sleeping as usual when we heard noise. The children were in this room. The curtains were behind the bars. It's good that they were there at least, because the windows flew there. Thank God that the children were not affected.
Russia launches a fresh assault on the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv. A barrage of drone attacks on Wednesday. 13 drones were shot down by Ukrainian forces, and officials there say the damage was limited and there were no casualties. It's the latest wave of assaults by Russian forces targeting Ukraine's power grid in a war that will reach its 10-month mark on Christmas Eve. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. This Christmas will be the first Christmas Ukrainians will celebrate amid the horror of the Russian invasion. But as we've seen time and time again throughout this turmoil, Ukrainians are holding strong, vigilant about protecting their borders. They've even been able to regain land the Russians once occupied. But it's not without heavy and heartbreaking losses. Since the conflict broke out, it's estimated that some 100,000 Ukrainian soldiers and 100,000 Russian troops have either been killed or wounded. That's according to General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But the exact amount of lives lost is hard to tell. Neither Russia nor Ukraine tend to officially release figures for casualties. Even harder to know is the number of civilian casualties. The Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights has verified more than 6,700 civilian deaths. More than 10,000 civilians have also suffered terrible injuries. And the UN estimates some 7.9 million have become refugees, fleeing the conflict after losing everything they have. It's the greatest displacement of Europeans since World War II. The Metropolitan of the Ukrainian Catholic Archeparchy of Philadelphia spoke with us about the plight of Ukrainians in this war as the holidays near, including the hope that they can find in the Christmas story and the parallels they may find in their own suffering.
Maybe this Christmas in Ukraine will be as close as possible to the circumstances in which our Lord manifested himself on this earth. Jesus is with those who don't have a home, and 14 million Ukrainians don't have a home. Jesus is with those who are refugees, and there are more than 7 million Ukrainian refugees. Jesus has to flee. There is a tyrant. There is a Herod that wants to kill him. A Herod whose power is threatened by an infant, by an innocent person, by an innocent Lord. And I think this Christmas will be like no other. It will be the most Bethlehem-like Christmas. It will be the most gospel-like Christmas that Ukrainians have celebrated in maybe centuries.
Now, as winter settles in, with temperatures consistently hovering at or below freezing, there's the added strain of power outages in many parts of Ukraine. EWTN correspondent Colin Flynn just traveled to the war-torn country to give us an on-the-ground look at how Ukrainians are coping.
We are 7 meters underground. We have here ICU, operating room, and beds.
And the roof of our sports hall, if you can see, was also hit by a missile.
We expect the worst, but we hope for the good.
We believe in a better future, and we believe in victory for our Ukraine.
We are sad because war never brings joy. It brings sadness and pain.
We will win, of course. What else is there to think about?
The physical destruction of war is hard to comprehend. What were once people's homes now practically lay in rubble, burnt, bombed, and destroyed.
We're here in the town of Borodyanka, and as you can see, these apartment blocks have been completely and utterly destroyed by the Russian tanks and the bombing. You can see half of the building has collapsed. The apartments that are still standing are completely burnt out, and there's just a row of this all down through the town.
But it's the human toll of this war in Ukraine that is most inhumane.
It's heavy.
Yegor is a 19-year-old Ukrainian soldier, and a few months ago, he lost his leg after stepping on a mine in the Donetsk region.
What do you remember from the moment when you stepped on the landmine? Were you knocked unconscious, or do you remember what happened?
Yes.
I remember everything, every minute, every second. I remember flying through the air and landing on my back. I looked down and saw that my leg was missing, and I realized I had stepped on a mine. Well, my first thought was to shoot myself, because I didn't want to be captured by the Russians.
Yegor was found by his fellow soldiers, and today is his first day with his new prosthetic leg. And as demand for these prosthetics are so high, they're being made right here inside the hospital. And under the hospital in the basement, they've built new wards and even an operating theater in the event the hospital is struck by missiles.
I want to return to the front line as quickly as possible and join my boys to help protect Ukraine.
Yegor's unbroken spirit is impressive, but with the bitterly cold winter icing over Ukraine, the next few months are going to be tough for the people here. Today, I'm traveling with the Catholic organization, the Order of Malta, as they deliver aid to this psychiatric hospital outside the capital, Kiev. Earlier in the war, this hospital was taken by the Russians, and the vulnerable patients were held hostage.
The patients helped each other to survive in this situation. For example, they made fires outside so that they could cook food, because there was no other option. The Russians were there with their weapons, all around the hospital.
A nearby school was also taken by the Russians. The soldiers sprayed "Moscow is victorious" on the walls of the corridors. They painted their famous V symbol in various places, and in some of the classrooms, they even drew sexually explicit images depicting small children.
They completely burned two classrooms into ashes and smashed all the desks and other material. It was terrible. And they wrote on the walls and on the tables. And the roof of our sports hall, if you can see, was also hit by a missile. That too remains demolished.
The Order of Malta and Maltese Relief Service have been working around the clock to provide supplies to the hardest hit areas. Pavlo Titko is the head of Malteser Ukraine.
The situation here has really changed because Russia is beginning to target their missile strikes at energy systems. At the beginning of the war, we helped people with food and medicine. But now, today, what people need is electricity and heat. So we are bringing power to people by distributing mobile generators and other supplies.
In this coffee shop in the capital, Kiev, the power has been out all morning. Its owner, Alexander Prokhorenko, and the staff
have been trying to do the best they can with no power or heat.
So now we have, as you see here, the electricity cut out. Well, it usually happens every day for 2 and 3 times per day. So we can be out of electricity for 2 hours, and it can be for a whole day. We never know.
His business is down 75%. He's only really staying open so the staff can keep their jobs. But how much longer they can go on like this, he's not sure.
Now we're not talking about the business. We're talking about just, you know, survival.
In the cities, at least they have some diesel generators and can support each other. However, the further you travel into the rural countryside, the more isolated and bleak the situation becomes. I'm traveling with the Order of Malta in a secret convoy to the north of the country to deliver supplies to villages close to the border with Belarus. This is a risky mission as we will be just kilometers from where Russian forces are situated, and so everyone is on high alert. As the convoy pulls up to the first village, you get a sense of what life cut off from electricity is really like. There are no street lights, no light from the houses, and no mobile phone signal at all. Sofia Mihal is the coordinator of this humanitarian mission.
We are distributing our goods, food to people from the list.
And the people here, as we can see, have no electricity, no telecommunications. They're completely cut off and isolated.
No light, no electricity, no heating, nothing, no communication.
A woman goes from house to house, telling the locals that supplies have arrived. It's dark and bitterly cold.
Things are not good because I have 7 children, and so it's very difficult. We have no power, no connection, no phone. We have nothing here.
For those with young families, they are finding it very difficult. Others are putting on a brave face.
You can get used to the power cuts. You can have a longer rest after work. Victory will be ours.
Well, of course we're worried, but we have to get through this. And here in the village, we will still celebrate Christmas.
Since the war started, 9 million Ukrainians have left the country, while others have become internal refugees. Many of them have ended up here in the city of Lviv in the west of Ukraine. This office building has been converted into a makeshift living quarters for a number of families, with 4 or 5 people living together in each room, sleeping on mattresses on the floor.
We are from the Zaporizhia region, which is now occupied.
This family, with small children, told me that they traveled for 5 days to escape the bombing, sleeping in their car along the way. Their baby was born just as the war started, and so has spent all her life as a refugee. And yet, the people's spirits still remain strong.
For me, the most important thing is that they are healthy and live in peace without war. Well, I think maybe the Ukrainians will win. That's what we want.
The Catholic Church here in Ukraine is trying to do everything it can to support its country. Father Zinovai Korkavai is the priest here and has the difficult task of trying to give spiritual relief to people at a time of war.
I thank God that maybe the war has united the Ukrainian people. Well, I want to say that the Church plays a critical role. It heals wounds that the whole of Ukraine is suffering from today, children, families, communities, and soldiers. And as the Apostle Paul tells the Jews, weep with those who weep, mourn with those who mourn, rejoice with those who rejoice. And we, together with the whole world, will be able to defeat the enemy, who is causing a lot of suffering, pain, and wounds in Ukraine today.
The people of Ukraine now face a very harsh winter, and with power cuts, lack of supplies, and the ongoing war, things are going to be tough. But yet, as you've seen, their spirit and determination remains unbroken, even in the face of such uncertainty. In Ukraine, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
EWTN Ukraine has been working diligently since the outbreak of the turmoil to maintain broadcasts of the Mass, gospel readings, and more. Our colleagues there have also taken long journeys to pick up food and other supplies for neighbors in need. The Director General of EWTN Ukraine, Father Oleksandr Zelensky, spoke with us on Wednesday just hours after multiple drone attacks in Kyiv.
The situation in Ukraine is still very difficult. The Russians want to destroy our power plants, to destroy and to do that, we will not have electricity, water, and the heating. We have some limit of, for example, electricity because we have just 12 hours a day electricity in Kyiv, for example. In another regions, there is sometimes worse situation. So they have a few hours just a day electricity. There is some tension, there is some fear in our heart, in the heart of people. It's not easy, but thanks to God, we will live. We try to work. We try to continue. We try to trust in God.
Father Oleksandr and his colleagues continue to bring joy to others suffering through this war. On the Feast of St. Nicholas, they brought presents, sang songs, and enjoyed treats with Catholic and non-believing families to build solidarity and community. Our prayers are with Father Oleksandr and our entire EWTN team in Ukraine. Still to come on EWTN News In Depth, a Catholic institution is thanked at a prestigious award ceremony.
That this is such an issue for our young people. The numbers are pretty staggering.
An archdiocese launches a suicide intervention program for teens that's quickly growing. Plus, Hail Mary's on and off the field. We speak with Catholics embracing their faith during the World Cup.
The holiday season is meant to be a joyous one, putting up decorations, attending parties, and singing carols. But for many, it can be stressful. And for those without close family and friends, it can be one of the hardest times of the year. Loneliness, depression, and disconnect can be common. In the Archdiocese of Seattle, a new initiative is starting to take shape that builds awareness about mental health year-round. Reporter Roselle Reyes explains how the program aims to save lives.
Even if I can help save one life, that's going to be what's most important to me, because every life matters.
Suicide, a sensitive and difficult topic people often avoid talking about. Avery's one of several high school students in the Archdiocese of Seattle who hopes to break the stigma about suicide.
Welcome to the Safe Talk training.
She is now part of the budding program, the Catholic Lifesaver Corps.
It came about because of a young person in California. His name was Jake Novak, and he experienced a suicide in his high school in Los Angeles. And he was disappointed in the school's response, which in his words was really to not do anything about it.
Jake was moved to become a fully certified suicide prevention trainer through a program called Living Works, where he met his trainer, David Pena. Pena then became inspired to start a teen suicide prevention ministry in his hometown, Seattle. He brought the idea to the leader of the Archdiocesan Mental Health Ministry.
What if we created an initiative that trains and empowers teenagers to be suicide prevention workshop facilitators for their peers and have a peer-to-peer model?
After pitching this new initiative to all 11 Catholic high schools within the Archdiocese and an extensive application process, the Catholic Lifesaver Corps held its pilot program in April of 2022. The first cohort involved 8 students from Archbishop Murphy High School and Pope John Paul II High School. These student facilitators have already held subsequent suicide prevention workshops in their schools, training more than 100 other students, parents, and school staff on how to pick up warning signs of suicide. Now, a second cohort consisting of 8 students from 2 additional high schools, the 2-day training retreat includes the Applied Suicide Intervention Skills Training, or ASSIST, and the Safe Talk, Tell, Ask, Listen, and Keep Safe workshop.
The class teaches and promotes identifying people who are thinking of suicide and referring them to an agency or a community that can support them to stay safe for now.
Eric Michels, who was a counselor for Odeya High School, says he is glad to be a part of this new initiative.
Having done this for 12 years now, I've just seen a huge increase in the amount of mental health challenges facing students nowadays.
The National Institute of Mental Health puts suicide as the second leading cause of death among teenagers and young adults in the U.S. Zach Dedeker, who is a junior in the second cohort, shares his personal struggle with suicide when he was in middle school.
You don't know what anyone else is going through, so why not share my story? Throughout those years in middle school, bad grades kind of affected me a lot. And it was all because I was kind of stuffing that down. I didn't have an outlet. And I kind of gave these signs, like maybe like a cry for help.
With the help of family and friends, he was able to pull through and in turn now wants to help others.
There's ways out of it. And you need to find the right people to talk to and the right resources. Your life's at risk, and that's more important than almost anything.
That is why learning how to intervene with individuals contemplating suicide is crucial for the Catholic Lifesaver Corps.
We're like on the front lines, if you will. I mean, the counselors are not going down into the classrooms to check up on every student. I'm the one down there talking to my friends. I'm the one that hears the cues, hears the indications of what they might be thinking and what they might be planning.
Students are then trained to facilitate workshops of their own so they can offer regular training in their respective schools and nearby parishes.
There is a plethora of ways you can miss, dismiss, or avoid suicide invitations.
At the conclusion of the training comes the commissioning and the blessing of the students during a beautiful prayer service here at the chapel.
May the blessing of God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit be upon you.
Our youth are important because they're the church of today. They're the leaders of today.
Catholic principles on the respect for life and human dignity are some of the grounding principles of the Corps. Students understand that life should be valued at every age, and every session begins and ends with prayer. The retreat helps to establish a strong sense of community, keeping them united in a commitment to save lives.
This has been pretty, like, eye-opening to me and to all my classmates that are doing this with me. I feel like it's also kind of brought us closer together because this is a difficult topic to reach out to.
Well, I'm just thankful for this opportunity, you know, for our students and for our community to see that teens can handle this topic and they can handle it in a really effective way. And I think it's really powerful and empowering for them to see that they can affect positive change.
Rosal Rages, EWTN News in Depth.
To learn more about the Catholic Lifesaver Corps, visit the Archdiocese of Seattle's website at archseattle.org. If you or someone you know is struggling with suicidal thoughts or despair, you can call the U.S. National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. Coming up on EWTN News In Depth, Ambassador to the Holy See, the 5th Secretary of Veterans Affairs, but his most important title, a Catholic. He shares how his family keeps hold of their faith through technology.
We don't want to be in a position to say no, but I think the reality is very close.
An influx of migrants leaves aid organizations stretched thin, and it's only expected to get worse with the termination of Title 42. But the Biden administration says help is on the way. Coptic Christians martyred for their faith in Jesus Christ. Now the families of those victims seek healing in the Holy Land. The organization trying to make that happen.
Bracing for a potentially historic surge of migrants at the border tops the Week in Review. It comes as the Title 42 COVID ban is set to end on December 21st. Title 42, implemented by the Trump administration during the pandemic, allowed U.S. Border Patrol to swiftly return migrants to Mexico or their home countries on the grounds of the public health crisis. The Biden administration released a plan on Thursday to deal with the expected wave of migrants. It includes increasing processing efficiency, bolstering nonprofit capacity, and imposing consequences for unlawful entry. Border cities say they're already overwhelmed.
We know that our NGOs are running at full occupancy. Our local shelters are running at occupancy. And couple that with the weather we had overnight today, cold weather, snow flurries overnight, our normal static homeless population is looking for a place to get into. And we're utilizing those shelters for migrants as well. So it does put that added strain.
19 Republican lawmakers requested to delay the termination of Title 42, warning that the influx could become a disaster at the border. Governor Gavin Newsom of California warned that his state is already overwhelmed. Title 42 expires on December 21st. President Biden signed the Federal Recognition of Same-Sex Marriage, or the Respect for Marriage Act, on Tuesday at a celebration ceremony at the White House. Supporters say it protects the LGBTQ community from discrimination. Critics, including Catholic Church leaders, say there's a lack of protections for religious organizations and it will hurt the sanctity of marriage. Deadly storms tore through southern U.S. states earlier this week. More than a dozen tornadoes were reported from Oklahoma and Texas to Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana. Louisiana suffering the brunt of the storms on Wednesday. After twisters destroyed homes and businesses, leaving at least three people dead, a woman and her 8-year-old son, as well as a 57-year-old woman. Dozens of people were injured and thousands lost power.
We've seen catastrophic destruction from both ends of the city, starting from the municipality right next to us, Jefferson Parish, all the way over to Orleans.
The mayor of Gretna, Louisiana, just across the river from New Orleans, says the storm was worse than Hurricane Ida. It was a scene that grabbed the world's attention. The beheading of Christians by the Islamic State in 2015 made headlines around the globe. ISIS-affiliated militants murdered 21 men on a beach in Libya. 20 of them were Egyptian Coptic Christians, martyred for their faith in Jesus Christ. The captives were dressed in orange jumpsuits and forced to kneel before the brutal executions took place. The families of those victims have lived with that heartbreaking reality for years, but have been bolstered by their faith. Now, in hopes of deeper healing, they desire to experience their faith in the Holy Land. A desire that the Philos Project wants to make a reality. The Philos Project is a Christian organization that works on positive engagement in the Middle East. Luke Moon, the deputy director of the Philos Project, is here now to tell us more about the families that they want to help. Luke, it's great to have you here. We just reminded everyone of the story of these 21 martyrs. What was it like for your team meeting their families?
Oh, it was incredible. I mean, the families went, the members of our team got to go to the church where these families were worshiping, where they were meeting. And it was like they were so happy that we had come to see them. And little did they know how excited we were to meet them. And when they met and they talked, they laughed. I mean, everybody was in tears a lot. And then the priest, he came up and he went to Robert Nicholson, our executive director, and he said, I have a question for you. Can we go to Jerusalem, you think? And of course, Robert was like, absolutely. I'm sure we could work something out.
That's incredible. Give us a little background. Has the political situation changed for all of the Egyptians in Libya, or does the threat of persecution still exist?
Oh, it's still ongoing. Libya is one of those places where Egyptian cops will go and try and find work. There's high unemployment among the Coptic community in Egypt, and so they go elsewhere, try and find work, and are often victims of persecution like they are in a lot of places. But, you know, the population of Egyptian cops has dropped from almost 300,000 down to about 40,000 in Libya, and I think a lot of it has to do with just the difficult situation that the Egyptians are under, and also random kidnappings do happen, and people just kind of disappear, and so it creates a real fear among the cops, and so they choose to go elsewhere.
Well, this makes this campaign even more important. Tell us a little bit more. Why Jerusalem? This priest had this desire in his heart. Why is this the place the families would like to go?
Well, I think that, if you're a Christian, you want to go to the place where Jesus was crucified and was buried. I mean, how powerful it is to stand on those places where Jesus taught and walked, and there's nothing quite like the holy city of Jerusalem. And to go to that place, I mean, these 21 martyrs, they were standing on the beach in Libya, and each one of them was asked whether they were a Christian. And there was one among them who was actually a guy from Ghana. And when they got to him, he said, "Yeah, I am too. I'm a Christian as well." And it was their testimony that at that moment brought that man to faith. And so you got to think that the families of those people who stood, with knives to their neck and made a public declaration of faith, that for them to go to the place where Jesus Christ died on the cross for them and for their families and for their whole community, there's nothing can be quite as powerful as that.
Absolutely. May we all have that kind of courage. Luke, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
And we continue to follow two cases of Catholic leaders targeted by the Chinese Communist Party. On Wednesday, 90-year-old Cardinal Joseph Zen appealed his conviction in Hong Kong's High Court. Last month, he was convicted for failing to register a fund that financially assisted Hong Kong pro-democracy protesters. He paid a several hundred-dollar fine. The case is cited as important for freedom of association in Hong Kong as Beijing continues to chip away at freedoms in the former colony of the United Kingdom. A close friend of Cardinal Zen and fellow Catholic is media tycoon Jimmy Lai. He's been imprisoned for 2 years on various charges stemming from his support for democracy and free speech in Hong Kong. In this latest case, the 75-year-old is facing charges of collusion with foreign forces under the draconian national security law that the Communist Party implemented in Hong Kong in 2020. Lai's trial was supposed to take place this week, but was postponed until late next year after his British lawyer was denied a visa extension. Chinese officials claim the non-Chinese lawyer is a national security risk. Lai was already sentenced to more than 5 years in prison on separate charges of fraud last week. Author of The Coming Collapse of China, Gordon Chang, joins us now to weigh in on these two cases and what they mean for the future of the regime and religious freedom. It's great to have you on. Is it possible that Cardinal Zen would be imprisoned once more? What's next in this case?
I think eventually the regime does not want Cardinal Zen in jail. It doesn't want a martyr. And so it'll do everything, I think, to try to just get by this. But this is important because he should be supported by the Vatican, and clearly the international community supports him because he's gotten so much in terms of support from everywhere.
And for Jimmy, the delay on his trial, that keeps him captive, he's going to be spending another Christmas in jail. Is there any hope for his release?
The hope for his release is that the United States and others pressure China to let him go. I think that, again, Beijing doesn't want to create a martyr. They would eventually like to see Jimmy out of jail. They don't want him to die there. He's 75. He's now got two sentences, which he's serving. The national security trial, as you point out, has actually been delayed. So this could be a problem for Beijing if he remains in jail.
And have the recent protests and outrage over COVID restrictions had any kind of impact?
I don't think so. The Communist Party's war on faith has gone on for a very long time, and it will continue for as long as the party rules. COVID lockdowns, yes, they have triggered these protests, which have been extraordinary. But the war on faith continues, regardless of what happens on disease.
And what else can the international community do? I know you mentioned the Vatican. There's a lot of talks of the relationship with Saudi Arabia. What else can be done to pressure China?
The most important thing is trade and investment. China right now, because of a plunging economy, really needs foreign money. And so I think that it's up to the United States to start restricting the flow of cash to China. If we do that, then we can accomplish a number of goals, including making sure that neither figure stays in jail, either Cardinal Zen or Jimmy Lai.
Well, we've got a lot at risk there, and we'll be praying for them. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And a happy anniversary to our Holy Father, who celebrated 53 years in the priesthood on Tuesday. Jesuit Jorge Mario Bergoglio, who is today Pope Francis, was ordained on the eve of the third Sunday of Advent, on Gaudete Sunday in 1969. According to the book, The Jesuit Conversations with Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio, Francis discovered his vocation to the priesthood while on his way to celebrate Gaudete Day. Francis was just 4 days shy of his 33rd birthday at his ordination.
It speaks to a further desire of belonging to something, belonging to someone, belonging to something that's bigger than ourselves, like a team that represents us.
A sense of belonging through prayer, through faith, and through sport. We speak with Catholic World Cup fans about how religion is reflected in soccer.
Something you don't often hear at a Heisman Trophy Award ceremony: appreciation for the lessons of a Catholic high school education. That's right. During the ESPN ceremony for college football's most outstanding player, quarterback Caleb Williams said his Jesuit education at Gonzaga College High School in Washington, D.C., taught him to be a man for others. That Catholic experience has made Williams a leader both on and off the field. At the University of Southern California, he has led the Trojans to a turnaround year, ending the season with an 11-2 record. Success has come early for the 20-year-old. Williams is only a sophomore. Lots more time ahead to bring home some hardware for the team.
Probably the biggest sporting event in the world, and you think about how many countries it brings together.
The World Cup becomes a world stage for players and all they represent, including their faith. While some players may make the sign of the cross during tense moments in a game, there are also a lot of murmured prayers by fans around the world rooting for their nation's team. EWTN reporter Mark Irons gives us a look at the faith on the field and in the hearts of the fans.
Every 4 years, the World Cup attracts millions of soccer fans across the globe. Cheering on their favorite national teams, they gather in stadiums or around the TV.
You just can't not be here.
For some, victory feels like divine destiny.
We have God on our side.
Support for their team tied to identity.
For a lot of football fans, football is like religion.
And there's no question at this World Cup, faith has been on display. For starters, more than half of the 32 national squads that qualified came from predominantly Catholic countries.
How's the game going so far?
Pretty good. I'm very stressed.
One example, Croatia, a small Eastern European country with deep-rooted Catholic heritage. They made it back to the semifinals after placing second in the 2018 World Cup.
Praise the Lord! Praise the Lord!
That was pretty amazing.
We joined Croatia fans at a watch party in Washington, D.C. during a tense victory over Brazil in the quarterfinals.
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
Among those cheering, Franciscan priest Father Maris Dulcich, who serves a Croatian Catholic community outside D.C.
Most every Croatian's Catholic, and I mean there are very few who are not Catholic.
That includes Croatia's star soccer player, who posts faith-related photos on social media, and their coach, who carries a rosary wherever he goes. When the game with Brazil went to penalty kicks, we saw another rosary come out, this one held by Stephen Bartulica, a Croatian member of parliament on business in Washington who took time out to watch the games.
And I take the rosary with me, and here's Croatia in the semifinals after beating Brazil.
The faith held close not only by Croatia. Look at Argentina, led by Catholic Lionel Messi, who said if he wins the World Cup, he plans to go on pilgrimage to San Nicolas, a holy site of Argentine Catholicism. And Portugal's Catholic coach talked about his prayer life in a recent interview, saying God gives him, quote, the gift of strength, determination, perseverance. This is what I ask for every day, that he supports me. The faith even etched on players' skin. Catholic French forward Olivier Giroud has a tattoo of Psalm 23 and teammate Antoine Griezmann a tattoo of Jesus on his arm.
There is a Catholic presence, like, without a doubt.
The signs of Catholicism at the World Cup caught the eye of a former pro soccer player who is now a priest.
Becoming a disciple and becoming the man that I was created to be.
Father Chase Hilgenbrink was ordained a priest 8 years ago for the Diocese of Peoria in Illinois. Before that, he played soccer professionally in South America. This World Cup has brought him back.
And I've re-encountered some of my passion for the game, for the sport that I haven't felt in a long time. And that's what the World Cup brings out of me.
Soccer fan Tim Person says he's seen faith brought out in World Cup players as they prepare for battle.
I feel that religion is a motivating force, especially the Christians when they enter the pitch and they take a little bit of the turf and cross themselves.
It's also been a significant World Cup for the Islamic faith. Qatar became the first predominantly Muslim country to host the event. In Morocco, a majority Muslim nation, advanced all the way to the semifinals. Muslim players seen prostrating themselves in prayerful thanksgiving. Morocco also represented the first African nation to reach the semifinals. As nations waved flags with pride at the World Cup, controversy was stirred by the gay pride flag, and religion could have motivated some of the response. In Qatar, homosexuality is prohibited by law. A number of team captains had planned to wear armbands in support of LGBTQ rights, but were warned by FIFA, the international soccer governing body, they could face penalties on the field if they followed through with their protest. The players ultimately did not wear the armbands, but initially a number of teams, including from predominantly Catholic countries Poland, Croatia, and Spain, reportedly said they would not take part in the LGBTQ advocacy to begin with. Religious beliefs may have played a role for Catholic athletes.
It is true that we love every human person, the infinite dignity that belongs to every human person, despite or in spite of their sexual preference. At the same time, right, like we don't need to be advocates for something, you know, that we don't believe in.
Every 4 years, the World Cup brings people together.
Well, for me, it's also family time, right? These are my boys over here.
Uniting all backgrounds.
It transcends national boundaries.
And motivating the viewer.
I'm so inspired by the excellence that I see on this field.
Fans connect over a shared appreciation of skilled performances.
And that connection is art, beauty.
And a human reality everyone faces from time to time, suffering.
The sport of the universe, it is universal.
Universality is something deeply rooted in the identity of Catholicism.
I mean, the whole word Catholic, Catholicos in Greek means universal. All nationalities, all peoples, all races.
Father Dulcich believes if fans look closer, soccer can provide more than entertainment. It can point to something higher. And for those striving to grow spiritually,
you've got to be focused in our faith.
Pay attention to the players who train to achieve their goals.
Keep your body healthy, and then the practicing, the discipline of practicing, is the discipline that wins out. That's the hardest thing to conquer in yourself for an athlete. Now think of that in a spiritual sense. Conquering our own will, you know, is the hardest thing.
As a former player, Father Hilgenbrink learned it firsthand.
I was so disciplined about what I ate and drank and how I slept. And I learned virtues every single day, and I practiced them every single day.
And he ultimately found his worth wasn't in wearing a particular sports jersey.
I give all credit to Jesus and his church, which led me to an inner strength.
As the World Cup wraps up, Father leaves a question for those with a religious passion for their teams who believe their identity is sewn into the colors they support.
So what is that passion in your heart? Why does that passion run so deep? And what is that about when you really look into yourself? You know, what more is there? Who am I when the jersey comes off?
Mark Irons, EWTN News in depth.
And prayers up for that final score. The next World Cup in 2026 will be held in North America. We'll be looking for more signs of faith on the field.
I feel not only firmer in my faith, but more knowledgeable or, you know, aware of the derivatives of our faith and the truth.
Jim Nicholson, the former U.S. ambassador to the Vatican, unveils how his family prayer time bolsters his understanding of the faith. And we take you on a pilgrimage to Mexico as we celebrate the patroness of the Americas. Stay with us.
And now, Now, the story of a family who grew up saying the rosary together. Today, more than 70 years later, they continue the tradition in a new way. One of those family members grew to the ranks of U.S. Ambassador to the Holy See. Jim Nicholson served from 2001 to 2005. He's also the former Secretary of Veterans Affairs. He shares how the rosary strengthened him in his humble beginnings and today in this week's Faith Journey.
Ambassador Nicholson, thank you so much for being with us for this personal discussion about your prayer life. What was it like growing up with seven siblings, unusual for today?
It was pretty difficult initially. When the war ended and everybody came home, including my father, housing was very scarce, and we ended up being homeless. And there were then five kids in my family. And we moved out in rural Iowa to an abandoned farmhouse. No electricity, no plumbing, rat infested. But we had a roof over our head, and my mother convened us every evening around a kerosene lantern to say the rosary together and to tell us that we had to endure and that with our faith we could get through this if we prayed hard and worked hard and study hard. We went to a little rural school nearby, and she was right. All seven of us ended up going to college. You know, the brother was an Army general, three teachers.
Wow.
The coach, a social worker, and a professional welder.
Wow.
And now we're back together, all seven of us, still alive, still in the church, and now saying the rosary together again using the miracles of modern communications.
So then your family prayer life was intense, and it was a gift that was given to you by your mother. Did you always keep the faith, and did your siblings also always keep the faith?
We did. And all of us are still in the church, and I don't think any one of us ever really left the church. I mean, it's not that we've all been saints. My sisters are saints, my three sisters. But my brothers and I, you know, everybody's had their trials and tribulations in life. But I think everybody has stayed in the church. And I can't say that about all the offspring. We have their 20 nieces and nephews. But they're, as far as I know, they're religious. And I think that all stems from my mother, whose possession of faith was extraordinary. And I mean, our living conditions were very difficult. We often didn't have enough to eat.
Wow.
But she held us together. When sometimes the social service people, such as they were then, kind of wanted to break us up.
So then what motivated you to start this prayer rosary during COVID virtually through the magic of Zoom, as you said? What was the motivation behind that? Coming back together, reaching out to each other?
You know, we have these memories of praying and praying together, but it had been a long time. But actually, it was my brother Patrick and my sister Donna who were talking together. And we always try to have a sibling reunion, and the pandemic intervened there. So they said, well, let's do what we can and convene electronically and for an hour each week. And we start out with what we call the organ recital, which is where we go around, people give their health report.
The organ recital.
and then we say the rosary. And every Wednesday, the glorious mysteries. And then have a subject that we discuss. Every seventh week, one is responsible for the program. And we've had very interesting program. We've had priests on there talking about apologetics.
Hmm.
We've had other people on to witness the faith of their life. You know, a nephew who's a doctor at the Mayo Clinic talking about pain management. I have a nephew who's a four-star general commander in Afghanistan.
Wow.
Talking about his responsibilities. So they're you know, mixed with good substance, and but always starting out with a rosary.
Prayer and formation.
Yeah.
Is this something that you decided to keep going just because it was more convenient or because there was something powerful that was happening with that?
Well, I think the enthusiasm about it is growing. I mean, people look forward to it every Wednesday. And now we have others joining us, nieces and nephews, and some of them stay for the substantive discussion, and I think others have to leave, but they're on there to pray together.
That's beautiful. At least they come in for prayer, which is, as you were saying, you're not sure exactly where everyone is in their faith journey, but you have an open invitation for every member of your family. Do you think that this is something others could replicate, that this example is one that some may have thought, okay, the pandemic's over, I don't have to do this anymore? Are you encouraging people to continue this?
Well, indeed. And it's so simple and so easy, but so meaningful. And I think it has great potential. I like to talk about it. I'm sort of an evangelist anyway, because I think the church needs a lot of evangelism. But this is a wonderful new use of a social medium to get people together and pray together in a real personal way among family. And I think the other thing it has the potential to do is that where there's tension in a family, it is sort of a neutral forum for them to come and be together and praying together, even though they may have an edge for each other, which is not the case in my family, fortunately, but I know of a lot of other families. So it's a wonderful opportunity to evangelize and, to do apologetics.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The idea that you, no matter what you're feeling, are going to come together to pray.
Mm-hmm.
And you can put aside the disagreements, put aside everything that you might not want to talk about, but that keeps you apart, to prioritize prayer, which does bring us together. Is there any message that you have? Any encouragement that you have for people who are just scared or worried about starting something like this with their families? Was it an easy transition for you, or is there something that you did or that maybe your siblings did to make it easy?
It's very easy. You got to get someone to volunteer to be sort of the producer or the engineer, to arrange the Zoom and the number, and then all you have to do every week is hit Zoom and dial 10 digits. And you're there, and a screen opens up, and there are your siblings or your family or whomever you've decided to be with. It's a wonderful opportunity. And then someone takes the lead, leads the rosary, maybe leads the petitions that we have for the day, for the week. It's just a great opportunity out there.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for sharing it. I hope that other people will follow your example.
Thank you for having me.
A beautiful message for Christmas, that prayer empowers us and connects us to those we love. This week, we celebrated the patroness of the Americas, Our Lady of Guadalupe. Her feast day on December 12th brought faithful from around the world to Mexico to pay homage. The Basilica is the most visited Catholic pilgrimage site in the world, and it's our feature in our Images of the Week.
Singers, dancers, musicians. The image of our Blessed Mother draws thousands, traveling step by step, some even on their knees, others camping overnight, carrying rosaries, depictions of her likeness, and their petitions to her feet. They come to venerate her, to thank her, and ask her for her intercession, finding hope and comfort in her universal message of help and protection to all mankind.
We ask Our Lady to wrap her mantle around us and around you this Advent season. That does it for this week's episode of EWTN News In Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. At this time next week, EWTN will be bringing you Christmas programming. Then, the week after, we're back with a special edition of this program highlighting EWTN News In Depth around the globe. We'll see you then.